This is part two of our special Polycrisis podcast event, and it's packed full with information that will make your resilience program better. The real question that we're answering today is, what does all of this have to do with you? Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode 130 of the Resilient Journey podcast, presented by the Resilience Think Tank. This week, Mark is joined by resilience legend Regina Phelps. Regina and Mark continue the conversation about polycrisis, the failing infrastructure, and why you should care. Regina says that we, as resilience professionals, don't dig deep enough into world news, and the way we sell ourselves in this profession is deeply flawed. She talks about the need for each of us to have situational awareness and be a bit more assertive. This is a fast-paced, full-circle conversation about polycrisis, and you don't want to miss it.
Hey, Regina, it is an honor to have you on the podcast. We were just talking about how you're an icon, and I feel like now... for folks who can't see because it's an audio only podcast, I just got a look. Anyhow, take a minute and catch people up on what you've been doing.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, there's so much going on in the world. I think that's where I'm spending all of my time. I have a lot of global clients. So it's Taiwan and China. It's, you know, the buildup of military in Japan. It's the Gaza-Israel war. It's the supply chain disruptions because of their Red Sea or the drought in the Panama Canal. And oh my goodness, yes, the collapse of that bridge in Baltimore. And so that's what I've been working on, are those kinds of things.
Well, and it's interesting that you talked about that, because that's kind of what we're going to talk about here a little bit. And I think that it's important for our colleagues to realize or remember that things like that matter to us in our day-to-day jobs. I think too often we get sort of stuck in this routine of, oh, we lost a facility, we lost our systems, and business continuity is very rote. Right. And if anything, it's not rote. It is not routine, for sure.
Absolutely.
If it is routine where you work, then I would encourage you to take a different look at it.
Right. Absolutely.
You spent a lot of time last year talking about polycrisis, right? I mean, it was kind of the word of 2023.
It was.
Conceptually, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you look around, you just mentioned all of the different things that you're dealing with. And I read an article that you wrote several months ago where you recommend that business resilience professionals focus on three distinct areas. Yep. Talk about those. What are you going after with that?
Yeah, sure. So the three things I mentioned were situational awareness, the issue related to having really established and well-practiced crisis management teams. And the third thing is crisis communications, which I understand many of our colleagues may not do all of those things, but those are the three things in my list. The situational awareness is so darn important, because just as my example of about the supply chain issues, many people that don't sort of follow more global things may wonder all of a sudden, why are we having these supply chain issues? Oh, I didn't know about the drought in the Panama Canal, or I didn't know about the thing in the Red Sea. Or, I mean, all of us know about Baltimore, but that's a more recent and local situation. But I think situational awareness is so important, and it's not easy when there's so much going on all over the world to try and be good at that. So, you know, and I talk at length about different ways that you can go about that. The second thing is the crisis management teams, because most people may not have the most practiced teams. They may not have the best processes. They may not practice enough or have enough clarity when they actually do or when they have an activation. And so, my gosh, this is like, I mean, if there was ever red lights flashing about what you need to be doing right now, it's making sure that your teams understand that when the bad thing happens, that they better have a good process for assessment, planning, activation, and the whole laundry list of things that I spend a good part of my day talking about. And then the third thing is crisis communications, which many of our colleagues aren't responsible for, but it's still something that you need to deal with. And the fact that you have pre-approved templates and you have processes in place about how you would actually activate your plans to do that. And my number one thing I always talk about is governance. So in communications, for example, one of the things I never find is a governance document, which clearly states Who has the authority to edit something, write something, and approve something? And if you don't have that clearly defined, then people think, all the executives in particular, think they have the right to do all three of those things, which makes the comms last forever.
I love that. And I warned you, you know, just before we started recording that you were going to say something that was going to take me off course.
Oh, go there. Go there.
This might be the world's longest podcast by the time we're done. But you said a second ago there that many of our colleagues don't have responsibility for crisis comms. You told me off air before we started that way back in the day, sorry, I shouldn't have emphasized way back in the day so much as
all
they
right.
did.
Go there.
Yeah. but you said that a lot of the work that you do today didn't even exist. So
correct.
I want to juxtapose those two statements and say, okay, in today's environment, a lot of us don't do crisis comms. But then again, back in the day, you invented stuff. So how much of that being assertive or being willing to jump out of the traditional lane of what we should be doing is a key component to what resilience professionals should be looking at today?
I think it's absolutely essential. I think, but and the advantage I have, Mark, is that, you know, we haven't done any marketing in my company since 1993. If you want what I do, you're going to find me.
Yep.
But for a lot of people, they don't have that sort of comfort, right? All right. And the other part about that is that, you know, if they say something that makes their boss angry, they're fearful about their job or what's going to happen to their, you know, their progression in the company. But what I think is really important is that we really do stand up and talk about what needs to happen. And what I see often, especially in the crisis management space, is it just doesn't. And a lot of times people will hire us and I'll develop an after action report that can be nice, but I'm blunt. I'm to the point. You know, you need to do the following things. And my theory is, look, they're either going to hire us again or they're not. But I think what I see is that crisis management in particular, the teams aren't well defined. Everybody is so deferential to the executives. I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. But it doesn't help. It doesn't help. You need to have really good strategic teams, and you need to have a really good tactical team that is empowered with authorities and responsibilities that they can act. And when I don't see that, I call it out, because that means you've handcuffed the people that are going to really do the job.
The people around the crisis management table have to be on equal footing with the CEO and tell the CEO, I'm sorry, I disagree with that.
Right.
And a lot of times that's going to fall right at the top chair, right? They have to create that environment or that culture where that's allowed.
Like when I do exercises, one of the things I always to really build on that just for a second, when I do exercises, in particular, I like the most senior person in the room, depending on what the level of the exercise is. I want the most senior person, and I want them to stand up there and say, look, we're going to make a lot of mistakes today. It's really going to be fabulous. We're going to really improve our processes. So I want you all to dig in. And what I want is that kind of sponsorship where people understand that we are all needing to do this work to get better. And that, and I want that person to give people permission to make big mistakes, because that's why we play, right? And
that's right. No, I couldn't agree more. So when you talk to audiences at conferences and things like that around the whole idea of polycrisis and these three steps that you talked about, how is that resonating with the average resilience professional? Are they getting it, or are you getting a bunch of sort of blanks, you know, blank stares?
I think that's a really great point, because a lot of times people say, well, you know, I only have one office and I'm in, I don't know, someplace in the middle of the United States or whatever. And why does that have to do with me? And so what I do is I really do peel it back. And so I think that's the important thing, is that I think a lot of our colleagues don't dig deep enough into the news. And that's not because they're not smart or bright. It's because they don't quite understand that so many things around the world are connected. And that's where the concept of the polycrisis is, frankly, so important. And you see that, I mean, the great example is Ukraine. You know, like when all of a sudden the Russians invaded Ukraine, a zillion things happened. First of all, you know, there was a whole destabilization of Europe, because 10 million Ukrainians left, all the women, all the children, they all went someplace else. Well, where did they go? All over Europe. which was very destabilizing. And many of my clients talked about that in those countries. And then you had the impact of things such as what was going on in the Black Sea and the movement of goods. And all of a sudden there were supply chain related issues. And then you start ticking through all the things that happened because of one event. And then you start to see that. And then the question is to look back to your work and say, okay, well, what do I do with that? And the idea is that you need to really think about how anything around the world really impacts you. Kind of like that virus that happened in China in December of 2019 in Wuhan.
Turned into a thing.
That turned into a thing, right?
Yeah, as I recall.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. The Prime Minister of Poland just made an announcement within the last couple of weeks saying, I don't know if you all realize this or not, but we are now in what he termed pre-war Europe.
Absolutely.
And if that doesn't get your attention and you don't start thinking about, you know, ways that could impact you, maybe it's time for a little wake up there too.
Right, right. So, and that's happening, by the way, globally, in not just that part of the world. So, yeah.
That's fair. No, that's a fair point. You said back in that article that resilience professionals were front and center when it came to the whole polycrisis thing. I'm interested to see if you think we're also front and center in something else that I'd like to kind of drill down into, one of the potential components of a polycrisis. It's the fact that the infrastructure in the United States is aging. Many feel that the U.S. infrastructure is falling behind. Do you agree with that? And do you agree that we as resilience professionals need to be front and center, particularly when it comes to business operations?
We're actually way worse than you're describing. And it's not me that makes that projection. There's the American Society of Structural Engineers that actually does a report about every 2 or 3 years. And I'll make sure that I can send you the link because I think it's actually a good thing for you to actually look at. So the American Society of Civil Engineers, not structural. What they do is they do a report card of our infrastructure. Oh my God, you should be scared to death. The grade of the country looking at 11 different forms of infrastructure is a minus C. Now the highest grade was a B, and it was in not anything that's terribly exciting. But what you should really get your attention is the infrastructure of roads, bridges, airports. Some of them are rated as D and D minus.
Wow.
Infrastructure like utilities, the electrical system. Now you may say, okay, I'm a resiliency planner and I, you know, what does that have to do with me? Oh my God, everything. Because people think about, okay, we did a hazard risk vulnerability assessment and gosh, it looks pretty good. Well, it probably doesn't if you actually dig into the infrastructure around your area. And that's the thing that I think people need to think about more broadly. So my big thing in life is I'm deeply curious. And if anybody follows me on LinkedIn, they know that because I post all kinds of things about many different issues. And so I'm deeply curious. And so when I start looking into a company, it's like, oh, let me see what's going on in that area. Let me see about some of these key things. What about their grid? What about water? What about, and next thing you know, it's like, oh my God, you guys are a wreck. And so what I would encourage our profession to look at is, first of all, I would ask you to go to the American Society of Civil Engineers, and they do have the report card. You can download it and you can see all the areas of vulnerability. Then you should be looking at your area and then asking the question, well, what are some of the things that align? And then start digging into, for example, your utilities. I mean, that's a really great spot. We make a lot of assumptions that things are okay when they are not. And now it's not just us that are in such bad shape, but we're in really bad shape. The other country that I saw very recently is the UK was talking about their issues related to infrastructure. Probably the best of all the countries that I work in is probably the EU. They still, you know, they have high taxes. What does that do for you? It usually gives you better infrastructure. And so I think the thing about us as a profession is that we need to be more curious. We need to broaden our vision about what could happen in our areas, even if you're in one place only in the U.S.
One of my favorite TV shows, one of the best shows I think ever written, was The West Wing. And there is an episode where President Bartlet says, a crisis occurs when things we take for granted are taken away from us.
Now, look at electricity is a good example of that.
Do you think? Yeah, I was just going to say, if we take this down to the simplest of terms, we talk about resilience all the time, and we say, okay, well, in order to do this particular function, those people or that function is dependent on a bunch of different things, systems, facilities. But if you drill it down, power, communications, so critically important. And so to your point from a second ago, if you say, well, so what? How does this affect me? Well, that's a perfect way that it could affect someone. So,
and personally too, not just your work. I mean, if you're in a region, right? And let me just sort of give you one more way of looking at that too. So I'm doing a really large job for a gigantic financial institution in the United States. And so we're putting out a putting in, you know, regional crisis management teams. And so the corporate mothership always thinks that they're going to be able to somehow fly in and save them, right? If they can't fix themselves. And so I'm creating a, you know, very straightforward narrative, right? Of this very simple training of this regional crisis management team, of which is a, you know, a big regional tornado in an area where this is very going to likely happen. And, you know, what happens is not just the building being impacted, but think about when you have a regional tornado storm, you know, is it just that one building that's impacted? No, it's, you know, everybody's house, or maybe their grandma's house got blown up with a tornado. I mean, what happens is that it impacts everything. So, you know, the work from home, it ain't working. So then what? So, and then can the corporate mothership fly in? No, they can't.
Right.
So, you need to empower people in those environments to be able to do some of the basic things. And it's not just emergency response, what we do in the first few minutes or first few hours after an emergency to protect lives. It's everything. Emergency response, business continuity, disaster recovery, crisis communications, blah, blah, blah.
One of the things I think our colleagues probably struggle with, I know I come across it regularly, pretty frequently actually, is an optimism bias from our clients, who will say things essentially like, oh, we don't really have to worry about that, or we'll be fine, or this, that, and the other. What have you found is a good tool maybe for combating that optimism bias?
That's a great question. So that's a cognitive bias. And I see that a lot, especially in even places like, you know, like Florida is a really good example. My clients down there or along the Eastern Seaboard. Oh, I know what a hurricane looks like. Oh, yeah. Well, you know what the last one looked like. Do you know what this one looks like? No, you don't. The best way to actually help resolve that in somebody's mind is to actually do a really well-designed exercise, A, and B, that you don't solve it. I've done over 3,700 exercises in my career, and I used to always make, except for the cyber ones in particular, but that's a whole other podcast, the issue related to having people sort of fix things at the end. But in reality, what I've discovered is that I don't do that much anymore. Because I've discovered, really, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, that if you fix things at the end of an exercise, then what happens is that people think, you know, that was hard, but it wasn't that bad. No, no. I want them to be miserable. And my theory about cyber exercises is I want them to cry.
What's interesting, too, because there's a little bit of psychology around this as well. We just ran one for this client, and it was their first one ever. So we didn't want to break their spirit,
right?
But we did want them to understand, sort of have that, oh crap moment of, yeah, you know what? We really do need to be paying attention to this.
Right.
That's interesting. We
do. I mean, absolutely. I think I've done a zillion of them, and I just, my theory has really changed over time. And I think that's because, again, to your point about earlier in our conversation, is that people may not understand what the real crises are in general. And there is so much going on. There's a blindness or there's an overload. And so, you know, people just can't stomach it, so to speak. But I just have to get their face in it.
Right. So going back to the infrastructure problem, I know recently Congress just passed the bipartisan infrastructure law. Is that going to help?
It's absolutely it's going to help, but it's a drop in the bucket. And if you go to the website for that program, they show you where things are happening. But if you go back to our C- grade by the civil engineers, you know, it's just a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit. And we need a lot more of those to actually improve us. And my concern is in the United States is that we are so divided politically that no one wants to give anybody else a win, if you will. And there's going to be such division that the country is going to continue to fall apart. And I'm talking about on the infrastructure side, not societally. That's a whole other podcast. But the issues related to us being able to literally move forward and get better is really tough, man. Really
tough. I agree. But you just, you know, did it again. And it just becomes so natural to talk about it that again, we're going to go back to the term polycrisis, because you have infrastructure issues on top of, or probably underneath of, whatever other major risks and threats that your organization is facing. And now interweave in there the geopolitical risk and all of the things that are happening along with everything else. Again, it's got to get your attention.
Right. So, well, one thing I've also done a lot, I think maybe tied to the poly crisis, but also more broadly, is that, so I've done pandemic planning in our firm since 1997, long time. But I never thought what would happen when it's over until I lived through one. And so about 2022, many of our clients said, okay, Regina, what's going to happen when this is over? And I was kind of embarrassed to say, Mark, I never thought about that. You know, all I thought about was planning for one. But I'll tell you what I did is I did a deep dive. This is the deeply curious, weird part of my background. So I did a huge dive into medical history. And what I discovered in reading a bunch of books and my staff, we pulled a bunch of stuff together, is that what's happening to us right now, this will not make you feel any better, is expected. Because in all pandemics, this is what goes on. And there are five distinct things that happen. And it's all under the big, broad umbrella of societal disruptions. And they're all, four of the five are kind of horrifying. And I'll just tick really quickly through them. The first one is the issue related to the distrust of government and the distrust of public health in general. All the vaccine mandates and blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
It is the rise of the autocratic leader. And you're seeing that in many places, including the U.S., where a leader say, alone, I can fix you. You know, I can make this better. And you're seeing that in spades, not only here, but also globally. The third thing is the rise of misinformation and disinformation. Now, this goes back. The oldest one we studied was 432 B.C.
Wow.
And so people are constantly making stuff up. They're using this as an opportunity. And there's a lot of historians believe that the rise of Hitler started post-1918 flu, which technically ended in 1922. And so there was a big blaming of Jews in Europe for the pandemic. And Hitler drove that. Just sort of let that sink in for a moment.
So I have a follow-up question. I'm going to wait for my follow-up question because you were only three of the five through your discouraging words. So go ahead.
Yeah.
By all means, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm always going to, there's one I always forget, but the one that I always forget one. And the fifth one I could say, I can't remember, it was a good one actually. And that's the rise of the worker. That historically, after pandemics, there's been a huge rise of both collaboration and unionization, where workers are banding together to fight for more benefits, more support, et cetera. And you're seeing that all over the world, but certainly in the United States, the biggest drive in unions for 40 years, which is actually benefiting a lot of people because it's raising wages and blah, 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 blah. But my point of this whole story is that there is a lot of things that are going on, and this is all predictable. And it has caused wars. It has caused major disruption. And so all the stuff that we're feeling, Mark, is on track, as awful as that sounds.
So let's talk about that track for a minute, because you mentioned Hitler's rise to power. I believe he was first elected chancellor in 1933. So you're talking about 15 years from the end of the First World War to 1933. Do you think that that track has been shortened, escalated, or made quicker because of social media and so much more global media today? Same thing happened, same people. It's not going to take 15 years now.
Right. Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think the general, just to sort of, before I completely answer that, the sort of cycle of this sort of messed up society is about 50 years. Now, is it going to escalate and be much quicker? I think the answer is yes, but will it still last 50 years? It could. The thing I would say to you is that social media in particular and the ability for us to basically influence the world with our social media activity in particular has a huge implication of this. And look how good the disinformation campaign is right now with China and Russia already in the United States ahead of the elections is a good example of that. But the issue related to that disinformation and misinformation and the fact that we choose our own echo chambers, right? So back in the old days, you and I are probably old enough to remember that there only used to be three news channels and you only listened to one of those three. And we all heard the same story, right? Well, now you just sort of die. You have an inclination or a curiosity and you dial into it and you can spend the rest of your life there. And you'll never hear another thing or another side. So therefore, we are selectively choosing what we hear all the time. And that's just spoon fed by all kinds of people. And a lot of them basically don't have our best interests in mind.
Okay, so we've been talking about polycrisis. Now we're talking about geopolitical things and we're talking about the infrastructure problem that we're facing. So my question to you for advice to our colleagues is, so what? What should we, in very practical terms, do about that?
It's a really great question. So I think you can't boil the ocean. You can't do everything. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to be really aware of, again, your area and your expertise and your region. So if you are in a, you know, if you're a one-person shop in a one-location business, then it's easier to get your arms around that. You know, you should not be assuming anything. So I think what I would say to you is that I would still look at all of these issues, for example, related to infrastructure. I would look at these issues about what happens if we have major civil social disruption over the course of the election. I'll be talking about that at DRJ. We still have to think about all those things. And if you have a global presence, then your job is just that much harder. But you're going to have to boil the ocean and decide where you're going to spend your time. Again, that goes back to when I wrote that article and said, okay, the most important thing for you to know is situational awareness, having a really good crisis management team. And then you know what the hell you're going to say to people in crisis communications, because that goes back full circle to how we started this conversation. You can't do everything. But if you know, if at least you have situational awareness and you know what's going to be coming at you or you can see it, then you can begin to forecast and change. If you have a good crisis management process, then you know what to do when you actually have it or when you're building up to it. And then if you know what you're going to say, then you can actually then be competent when the bad thing happens or whatever you're saying before it happens, getting ready for the bad thing.
There are two things that come to mind. We're hearing people are saying that their executive teams don't see value in what they're doing. And I've also talked to some people who seem quite bored with the profession. I don't see how in 2024, as you said in your article, as we live in interesting times, that either of those two things can be true. Because if we get out there and we are deeply curious, as you said, and start thinking from a situational awareness standpoint, our program is going to be moved. We as professionals are going to be moved into action into a good way. And I deeply appreciate what you said there. I think it was brilliant.
Well, thank you. Let me just add one more thing to that, because I think this goes back to another issue, is that our way that we sell ourselves in our organization, I think, is deeply flawed. I've lectured about this and written a zillion articles. Many of our practitioners always talk about return on investment. I think that's a huge mistake, because the vast majority of us never have an activation every year. Mm-hmm. And then the worst thing that could happen is you have an activation, but you know it's resolved quickly. And then they think like, well, why are we doing all this stuff? The biggest mistake we try to sell ourselves is that we are going to save you money. That should be a little sub particle of how we sell what we do. There's another term called value on investment. I have lectured and written about this extensively for the last 10 years. And it's basically, I didn't come up with this cute little term, Gartner did. And it's basically, how can you show that you are providing value when you didn't actually save them any money last year. Mm-hmm. How can you do that? Well, you can't point to an ROI concept. You have to say, what is the value you provide every single day? And if you can't do that, then you better rethink your business right now. And so what I always say to people is, this is your most important task. What value are you providing? And it should be things like, you know, our business continuity plans are so robust that when something does happen, or even when we have a big transition in staff, they have the ability to look at those things, and it's good for training, as an example. I mean, you can talk about what the impact that it has on your board of directors because you have a really effective program for response. I mean, you should be able to list 10 things in the elevator when your CEO says, what value do you provide her every day? And it better not be, I'm going to help you when the bad thing happens, because it doesn't happen that often, Mark. But I just wish I could get our colleagues to stop talking about ROI, because it does not help.
I love that. All right. I sort of have an iconic question that I've been asking guests here for quite a while. And if I'm honest, I could have skipped right to this question and opened with it. I'm so interested to see where you land on this. So you speak at all kinds of conferences and events and things like that. If you had the chance to pick a song that was played after you're introduced, as you're walking to the podium, what song would you pick and why?
Oh, this is the funnest question I've ever been asked. And so I have to tell you, I cheated a little bit. What I did is I went to ChatGPT. And because I love to talk about AI as well. So let me just tell you what the question is that I actually asked. So I said to ChatGPT, by the way, I play with it every day because I figured that if we aren't playing with it, it's a problem, because we all need to understand it. So I said the following.
I agree. Okay.
I'm a global crisis manager. I do many speeches and interviews and write extensively on crisis management for large corporations worldwide. I've been asked in a recent interview the following question. You're always speaking at a conference or an event, but I have to ask you, if you had to choose a song to be played as you were walking to the podium, what song would you choose and why? I think the song should be positive and yet speak to the challenges that life can toss in our paths. What suggestions do you have for me? And I got 7.
Okay.
There was one I would have picked, but so Eye of the Tiger was one.
Yep.
Beautiful Day. Heroes by David Bowie. I thought that was good.
Okay.
Stronger by Kelly Clarkson. You know, what doesn't make you stronger? What doesn't kill you makes you stronger?
Right.
Fix You by Coldplay, Stand By Me by Ben King, and Don't Stop Believing by Journey. And at the end of it, I want you to read the paragraph that Chat wrote me.
Okay.
Each of these songs carry a message of strength, hope, and resilience. Qualities essential to your work in global crisis management. The choice depends on the specific tone you wish to set and the emotions you wish to evoke in your audience as you step up to speak. Whether it's an underlying spirit of fighter, the optimism of a better tomorrow, the acknowledgement of support and unity, or the celebration of overcoming adversity, your selection can powerfully enhance the impact of your presence and words.
Where do you think you would land?
It's really easy. So I, as a woman, I chose Stronger. What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Stronger by Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah.
And I think what that was all about is the ability that moving through difficult trials and being able to continue and to be even stronger because of it. And after 42 years of practice, I think that's what I do.
You and I started the conversation even before I hit record, talking about the R word, talking about resilience. Mm. But really, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger is resilience. I mean, it really is. And I love what you picked there. I think that was fantastic.
Thank you. It was a great question. I loved it, by the way.
It's my favorite question, and people get a kick out of it. And it's the one, by the way, that everyone has to do homework on before they come to the podcast. They're like, right. Somebody will say, oh, I went and talked to my wife about that. What song do you know? They're like, it's almost a panic, which is fine. Hey, you're probably connected to everybody in the industry on the planet, but how can, you know, if there's anyone left who doesn't know you, how can people connect with you?
The easiest is two ways. They can always find me on LinkedIn. I love to hook up with people on LinkedIn and cyber chat. And the second is if you just Google my name, you'll find me in the first, I don't know, five or six pages. I'm pretty much the only Regina Phelps out there, apparently.
And people should not be intimidated by your status. You're extremely approachable. And
yeah. Well, you know, the other thing I would say to you is that I think what I love and love doing recently in the last maybe, I don't know, 5 years is I connect with lots of younger people on LinkedIn, people that are thinking about the business or yeah. they're in it. And I've been mentoring on an average about five or six people. And I meet with them on a regular basis and give them homework and send them off. Because I think that's, I mean, for those of us that have been around for a while, we should be helping other people succeed. That's how I look
yeah,
at it.
We start to think about our legacy, and we do need to start thinking about giving back and mentoring. And I love that. Regina, this has been fabulous. We're a little over time. I don't even care. Thank you for doing this. And you know what? I think you should come back. And you and I should compare our notes on cyber response, cyber crisis management. We could have an interesting conversation around that. I think that would be a fun thing to do. But anyhow, thank you so much for doing this.
It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate the invitation. Thank you, Mark.
We want to thank Regina Phelps for being our guest this week and giving us some excellent takeaways regarding situational awareness and for opening our eyes to the dangers related to aging infrastructure. The Resilient Journey is a Resilience Think Tank production. Next week, we will build on what we've learned about polycrisis as we speak with a resilience coach. No, make that the resilience coach, Russell Harvey. So join us, won't you, as we continue our resilient journey. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.